Yurt dışına çıkacaklara müjde. Miles & Smiles Garanti BBVA kredi kartlarıyla yurt dışında toplam 60 bin lira ve üzeri fiziki alışveriş yapın. Garanti BBVA'daki varlık tutarınıza göre tek yön uçak bileti değerinde 8500 mil kazanın. 30 Nisan'a kadar ilk alışverişinizden önce bonus flash'tan kampanyaya katılmayı unutmayın. Ayrıntılı bilgi Miles & Smiles Garanti BBVA.com ve bonus flash'ta. Miles & Smiles kredi kartları 2000 yılından beri Garanti BBVA'dan.
Hello, my name is Pelinos. I'd like to welcome you all to our program that we organize as Istanbul Policy Center Sabancı University Stiftung Mercator Initiative in collaboration with Medyascope. Today we are going to be talking about EU migration policies and controls, taking EU and Turkey into focus. Recently, the lives of migrants and refugees are becoming even more difficult as the winter is approaching. And the situation in their countries are getting worse in their original countries, and challenges in the countries that they're trying to migrate are also, the conditions are getting worse as well, because globally we are still facing many different challenges like COVID-19, economic crisis, climate crisis are still pressuring the countries in different scales. Given the tragedies and escalated tension in Belarus, EU border a few weeks back, which indeed was one of the many incidents of migrants trying to enter Europe, we would like to talk about migration policies and controls in the EU today, and Turkey as well. So I have two guests. I would like to introduce them to you. My first guest is Karolina Gustova. She was our former fellow in 2020-21 as a Mercator IPC fellow. She worked with us for a year, and now she has a postdoc position at Aston University. Welcome, Karolina.
Thank you.
And my second guest is Senem Aydın Düzgit, who is our Research and Academic Affairs Coordinator at IPC, and who is also a Sabancı University faculty member. Welcome, Senem Aydın Düzgit.
Hello, thank you, Pelin.
Thank you very much for joining us today, both of you. Maybe we can just start with a general framework of how EU is dealing with migration, because there has been a massive influx of migrants, refugees trying to cross the borders to EU member states to begin a new life. But of course, seeking asylum in Europe is quite challenging and their chances are quite slim. How would you like to frame the issue for the EU? We can start with Senem Aydın Düzgit. You have the floor.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Pelin, and thank you very much for this question. Well, this is a broad question, but if I'll have to simplify the answer, I would have to say that the EU is not dealing with it. What it's doing is that it's basically, it's made, at least some member states made an attempt to find a common solution to the issue, especially after the onset of the Syrian conflict. But then it became quickly clear that there was not going to be unanimity or any agreement on the establishment of a common asylum policy where each and every member state would be subject to certain rules and conditions regarding, you know, how many migrants they would let in and the policies that they would go through. So, and because they cannot reach that kind of agreement, what the EU is doing is that it's basically externalizing its policy of migration control to third countries. So it's signing third country agreements, such as the EU-Turkey deal that it has with Turkey. But I think it's important to underline that Turkey is not a unique case in this context, that the European Union signs readmission agreements of different types and sorts with other third countries as well, and basically tries to create a buffer zone between EU borders and the actual source of migration and the transit countries. And that's how it's trying to deal with it. But of course, this is not, as we've seen, I think, over various crises recently, with Turkey, and of course, most recently, the tragic incidents in Belarus, I think they show us that this policy is not really working. I mean, of course, on the one hand, you know, you might have some people who argue that the numbers, that the number of migrants that are entering the EU are being reduced. So if you look at it from a, you know, completely numeric point of view, you might have a certain case. But if you look at it from, for instance, the way in which you're empowering third-party autocrats such as Lukashenko in Belarus, that, of course, that there is a different sort of power imbalance that's emerging with the way in which these third-country authoritarians are leveraging the migration issue vis-a-vis the EU. And also, of course, there is a humanitarian tragedy that's unfolding that's doing a lot of damage to EU's so-called normative standing. At least that's been in parlance since the early 2000s. And I think, you know, the incident probably that has done most damage to EU's claim, at least, to be a bit more normative than other international actors has been this migration issue. And of course, people have been suffering. And so it doesn't seem to be working, but the European Union did not or has not so far come up with an alternative that will create, that will sort of foster a more sort of a caring, a more normative, a more principled standing or position towards migrants that are fleeing from, you know, war-torn countries like Syria, like Afghanistan and elsewhere, and that also still manage to protect its borders to a certain extent. I mean, this is not being possible, of course. I mean, there are various reasons for this. First of all, there are certain countries in the European Union that do not want to engage in any kind of burden sharing whatsoever, partly because some of them don't have any history with migrants and there's very strong anti-migrant attitudes that are shared all across the political spectrum. Here, of course, one thinks of countries in Eastern Europe in particular, like Hungary and Poland and elsewhere, where there has also been extreme reluctance for any burden sharing when the EU first, was faced with this first wave of migrants after the Syrian war broke out. So there, you know, there is no incentive as well, because these countries argue that they're not really the primary destination here and they should not really be engaging with this kind of thing. And now on top of that, in more sort of core and older European Union member states, you have the problem of far right and extreme right wing movements and political parties, which of course has for long capitalized on this issue of migration. And what we actually witness in countries like Germany, for instance, during, again, you know, back in 2014, 15, when the debates and discussions on the migration issue were at a peak, again, after the Syrian war, what you saw is that a rising popularity, for instance, for the extreme right-wing party, AfD. So there is a situation where mainstream parties are, or at least they're justifying their positions on migration, on the fact that they're trying to contain the agenda of these far-right parties and make sure that they don't occupy more ground than they already do. And again, just as with, you know, the numbers that seem to be declining, you also see the popularity of these movements declining as the migration issue is not a priority issue in the domestic agenda of these member states. So it creates really a situation in which there is, you know, at least sort of political ground for the EU countries to insist with this externalization policy, whereas, you know, whether or not it's delivering politically for the migrants, regarding, you know, sustainability of EU's policies, regarding EU's relations with these third countries with which it's signing these readmission agreements with, is a big question mark, and in my opinion, is not sustainable in the longer term. And maybe a final point, because I don't want to dominate too much the discussion, and I would like to, of course, listen to Karolina's points on these as well, that, you know, one of the main reasons for this is, of course, not just because, you know, you have this sort of public opinion on migration in Europe and you have this reluctance for burden sharing because of various reasons that I've just outlined, but also the alternative to burden sharing, or another alternative way of dealing with this is actually going to the root sources of the conflicts, right? And the root sources, of course, are mean. If you go to the root sources, then you would be expected to have a more or less common foreign policy and an assertive foreign policy on issues such as the Syrian conflict, for instance, or in Afghanistan, for instance, or on how to deal with Belarus, for instance. And because the EU lacks a foreign policy that goes to the root sources of these conflicts in these war-torn regions, and since it's difficult for it to forge such a common foreign policy, given the political divisions and divides that exist between the member states, it's left with no policy option but externalization, at least no short-term policy option. And this is where it leaves it with. So I think I'll finish it at that for the first round.
Thank you very much. It was a very good introduction to the point on how EU is dealing with or is not dealing with the migration issues. The externalization is the way, and keeping the migrants in third countries is the way that the EU is going with at the moment. But of course, there is the consequence of all of these in those countries also for the EU in the later periods. Maybe now we can continue with Karolina and see what is her take on the Belarus issue, the situation in Belarus, and the role of the non-EU states within this EU migration controls in terms of externalization of the issue to non-EU countries.
Hello everybody, and thank you again for inviting me. And I think Senem started brilliantly pointing out the major issues, but I just want to add that along the externalization, there is another response by the EU member states, which is the border closure and unofficial and often violent responses. Right. For example, during my PhD, I was living in makeshift camps alongside Bosnian-Croatian border for 8 months. And every day what I was doing was monitoring border violence. And we had dozens of testimonies every single day and hundreds weekly when people were being pushed back from the EU member states, including Croatia, Slovenia, previously Hungary, where people were violently attacked. And after they were illegally deported, which right now is being called pushback, to non-EU zones such as Bosnia and Herzegovina, which we see on the same scale from Greece to Turkey. And it has been occurred as a major response, as a major unofficial and violent response by the EU member states. So, and of course, after we have this externalization, as Senem pointed out, but the major problem with externalization is that often it applies the same policies homogeneously across completely different contexts. And we can see that in Turkey and in Libya, in Sahel, and in many different countries, of course. And as Senem pointed out, she said that the EU assumes that it's normative power, which means that EU often positions itself in the center of externalizations and really kind of relies that non-EU states are going to Europeanize their policies, or they're just going to follow the EU demands. However, what we see, the third states counteracts. They are autonomous agents who have their own security, political, financial interests, and they really know how to use them to counteract against the EU in these migration bargaining, striking deals, and so forth. I think with Belarus, what hasn't been really discussed, that Belarus itself was a part of the EU's externalization. I mean, 2016, 2017, we can see obvious cooperation between Frontex and Belarus, in a sense that Frontex was training border guards in Belarus. The EU also dedicated quite a big chunk of money to construct removal centers. Frontex was cooperating with Belarusian border patrols on interception operations, removals, let's say removals of migrants from their country and so forth. Also, President Lukashenko threatened the EU about migration, sending migrants to the EU in 2002 and 2004. So, of course, I mean, there were some signs when this not could be fully predicted, but I think that the EU could really much more read these signs and not strike deals and negotiate with countries that have poor democratic records and that at the same time criticizes for poor democracy. But during one of the interviews with a member of the European Parliament recently, she says that everything is better than migration in the EU. And we can really see that on externalization. When the EU is really cooperating with states, which criticize at the same time, and which would never really fully engage on any other issue than migration at such a scale. So I think that this is really important to say. And I think that what we see again at the Belarusian border, makeshift camps, the photos of really extensive, large makeshift camps, pushbacks, violence, emergency state being enforced in Poland, border closure, more border patrols being sent to the Polish border. This is not new. And of course, often Belarus is being blamed as a third state, as a person or Lukashenko specifically for abusing these migration issues. At the same time, the closure of the border, denial to seek asylum in the EU, and using unofficial and violent responses when pushing people back to Belarus, which is not a safe country, and we all know that right now. And that's why the EU actually imposed sanctions against Belarus. It's, again, something not new, but we have been observing it since 2015.
Thank you very much, Coralina. And also, of course, what we recently saw in Belarus is not something very new to us. And also, when we look at it in Turkey, we had a recent issue in Edirne, where also there was threatening of Turkey opening up its borders and leaving all these migrants that are living in Turkey to Europe. And that was also a tension between Europe and Turkey. So in a way, migrants are now being instrumentalized in the policies between these two entities. Maybe we can talk about with Senemay Dündüzgül, we can continue understanding how this issue actually finds its shape between EU and Turkey, because there has been a migration statement that was signed, and what was it all about, and what is the consequence of that for Turkey?
Okay, thank you, Pelincim. Another big question.
A big question.
Another big question I might have to, I'm afraid, over perhaps simplifying the answer, so mm-hmm. I'm sorry for that, because, you know, many scholars have tried to, you know, are still trying to respond to this question, on, you know, what it means, what the EU-Turkey deal actually does and did and will continue to do if it continues as such. Now, regarding the first part of your question about where this whole deal came from, I mean, of course, it came with the Syrian war, right? The civil war and the fact that, you know, I mean, of course, different than to today's conflict with Belarus, what's happened at the time was these people were basically just, you know, fleeing Syria and trying to find a safe country of haven for themselves. So that was a completely different setup than today, for instance, with Belarus, when we see, as you said, also a deliberate instrumentalization of migrants, right, in a foreign policy dispute. Because obviously the big problem is the sanctions that Lukashenko is facing because of the way in which he rigged the elections and his authoritarian rule, basically. And that also there are sanctions on, you know, people who are associated with the regime. There are economic sanctions on the regime, and they're not recognized by the EU. So, I mean, basically, he's using this instrument and instrumentalization of migration to the effect of getting more recognition by Europe or getting at least some leeway through the sanctions, etc. So there you have a different case. With the Turkey issue, of course, there was this incident in Edirne, as I know. But if we go back a little, you know, way back in history, a bit beyond that, we see that it didn't start off as such. It really started off as a process when people just started to come in numbers, and then they were in massive numbers, of course, as if you go back to those days. So there was a time in which the EU was, you know, in a state of panic. And Turkey was one of the main transit countries. And that's how the EU-Turkey migration deal really happened. And of course, the deal happened also because Turkey was expecting certain concessions from the European Union at the time. For instance, at the time, you know, Turkey was pushing for a visa liberalization agreement. That was one of the priority issues on the government at the time, led by Davutoğlu, the former foreign minister and later the prime minister. And of course, there was also the question of, you know, money and financial assistance, because most of these people were going to also stay in Turkey. So that was known. So that's how the deal really was born, right? But what it actually did is that Again, going back to our initial points about the numbers, yes, if you look at the numbers, you see at least, you know, our colleagues have been telling us that the numbers have gone down, the numbers that have been moving Turkey as a transit country and entering into the European Union has gone down. But if you look at the situation, of course, Turkey is not a safe country for refugees, right, according to international law. And the European Union knew this, but, you know, that was, European law was nowhere near it. That's why EU-Turkey agreement is a statement. It's not a legal agreement. The European Court of Justice has no right on it whatsoever. And this is the reason, because EU leaders knew that if this was a European agreement, and if there was any possibility of this being taken to court, it will be unlawful. So this is why it's a statement. So there is this, and that the basis of that is the fact that Turkey is not a safe country for migrants according to international law, right? So these people, I mean, you were asking what happened is that, you know, yeah, Turkey ended up with more than 4 million Syrian migrants. And because the deal only focuses on this issue of transit and movement, that is mobility, it had nothing to say about the integration of these people and the cohesion of society as such, right? It had very little to say on those issues, and it focuses, and still, I think, discussions focus too much on actual mobility rather than, you know, the integration or what could be done for the social well-being of society with these people living, because obviously these people are here to stay, right? I mean, it looks like, I mean, at least research shows us there's very little tendency for the migrants to move, you know, and to make a move towards Europe or elsewhere once they're settled. So that's where we are with the deal. And on top of that, I think, what the deal has done, and I think this is more damaging for Turkish democracy, that it has given a huge leverage on the part of Turkey and on the part of the president, vice versa, the European Union, right? We know that since the deal, the European Union has been extremely silent on, you know, regarding issues that have to do with authoritarianism and democratic erosions and erosion of checks and balances and all of that within Turkey. And of course, that silence might also have to do with other reasons, but I think an important reason was the fact that the EU did not want to risk and does not want to risk the migration deal. And I think what happened in Edirne was just a sign that this deal could be leveraged against the European Union, right? In cases where Turkey faced a threat or faced a certain, you know, huge conflict with the EU on whatever issue. So yes, perhaps we haven't seen an instrumentalization of migrants at the scale that we've seen in the case of Belarus, but it doesn't mean that this is a possibility that we can rule out or that the EU can rule out. And this will obviously continue to condition its actions towards Turkey as well.
Yes, it seems like Europe actually wants whatever that they can do to keep the migrants out of Europe. So they took any kind of measures necessary and possible that they can take. Maybe Karina, what would be your comments about the consequences of this in Turkey, the consequences of externalization of the migration issue? Because you also, when you were working as a fellow at IPC, you also looked at the Turkish-Iran border and the effects of EU's externalization policies on this border. Maybe we can hear your comments.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is, for me, I think this is a very important question to look beyond the EU's physical borders, especially the eastern Turkey's borders. I think that what is most commonly discussed with the EU-Turkey deal is the impact on Syrian refugees as the largest refugee community in Turkey. And the humanitarian aspect of the deal, right? Like aiding refugees or helping refugees to survive and so forth. However, the scholarly work really shows that this humanitarian aspect of externalization is often on the edge of securitization in a sense that it always the major purpose is to stop the movement, to prevent the movement. And although it sounds something positive, some scholars argue that it's pure enclosure in non-EU zones and in often complicated and non-safe zones. But what hasn't been discussed too much is the border securitization, not just along the EU-Turkey borders, Turkey's borders with Bulgaria and Greece, but also the Iran-Turkey border. Because the other big refugee population in Turkey are mainly Afghans, followed by people from Pakistan, but also from Bangladesh, from Iraq, and so forth. And these people initially enter Turkey from Iran, most commonly. Not just because of geography, but also because of extensive smuggling networks and smuggling history in the region. So I think that when I was interviewing some of the EU authorities who are based in Turkey or who have close collaboration with Turkey on migration, they often stated that Eastern Turkey is the future EU frontier. Although Turkey is probably never going to join the EU, although still for migration cooperation and for externalization, it's still considered as a potential future EU frontier. And also, the EU is really trying to stop the movement already at this point of the border. What happened in Afghanistan recently really showed us that the Commission is proposing further externalization, not just to Eastern Turkey, but also to Iran and to Pakistan, really to stop the movement of Afghans in the region and searching for more regional solutions and focusing more on externalization rather than internal border management and migration asylum. But in practice, what I observed and what probably most people in Turkey know about right now is the border construction, the border wall constructions and deployment of surveillance technology. I mean, at the same time, we all know that since the 1980s, this border has been highly militarized because of the ongoing conflict between Turkey and the PKK. So this border militarization and border controls and border constructions are not really new, but they are adding to further militarization. And the EU already even admitted that it partially funded this border wall. And the Turkish Minister of Interior said even that the EU contributed with 110 million euros. Of course, after there is the EU is also aiding Turkey's border surveillance system and controls within the pre-accession assistance when supplying Turkey with different thermal cameras, surveillance technology, helping training of border guards and so forth. And again, often, I mean, there is this huge assumption that the aid from the EU often goes to NGOs, international NGOs in Turkey. However, this is not the case because the border patrols and the people who survey the borders are often the same people connected to military and gendarme who are fighting terrorists in the eastern border. So I think that here is the point of the paradox a little bit, that the European Commission often in the same report or the same text criticizes Turkey for its military measures against terrorism, often leading to different human rights violations. However, it aids the same spaces and the same units for border controls to stop migration to the EU. Also, the threat within the EU-Turkey deal not only allowed the institutional construction for aid for Syrian refugees, but also constructed removal centers for people who are mainly non-Syrians, such as Afghans, Pakistani, and people who enter from the east, to remove them much more quickly. And also the EU supported Turkey in a sense to strengthen its readmission agreements with many of the Middle Eastern countries and to very much fasten the process of removing migrants who would potentially move onwards to the EU to fasten the process to remove them away from Turkey or outside of Turkey. But what I saw on the ground is often the paradox when people are subjected to much more constraints, violence, militarization and problems alongside that they don't have access to asylum in Turkey, because this is very important point to mention, actually, that non-Syrian and non-European people can claim in Turkey only international protection, which is dependent on their resettlement from Turkey to third countries. However, these third countries, which could be the EU, the US or Canada, often do not offer too many opportunities to resettle these people. So Turkey is somehow suddenly struck with these people that if they offer them international protections, often they overstay, which I met, for example, Afghan refugees in Van who said they have been waiting for 10 years to be resettled, and they had no clear information whatsoever if it's going to happen, and if it's going to happen, if for them or one person from the whole family or for whom. And these conditions alongside the border security really push people to make decision to move forward to the EU, to not to stay in Turkey but pay more money to smugglers and make their chance to move towards the Western and Northern Europe, where they believe that this is the only place where they can have their rights secured, they can claim asylum, and they can live in peace.
Thank you very much for all those insights. It's very valuable to understand the situation from the ground as well. And when we see all the situation, it's really hard to look at the relations between EU and Turkey, because Turkey has always been criticized not meeting up to the values and the normative values that EU is presenting, like human rights, democratic rule of law, and all of those. But these security-based orientation towards migrants, how should that be evaluated on the side of EU when given the normative rules and principles in the EU being prioritized? How would you comment on that, Senem Hocam?
No, okay, so that was for me. Yes. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I mean, I guess what you're asking is its relationship to this argument or discourse on normative power Europe, right? Yes. How it contradicts. And well, I mean, I think to be able to reply to that, we first need to go back to the roots of this argument about normative power Europe and where it really came from. And it was really a term that was coined back in early 2000s, more precisely with an article by Ian Manners in a JCMS article in 2002, where he referred to the EU as a normative power Europe that, you know, has basically the power to inspire others in its wider neighborhood, but also beyond, to take up certain norms that are associated with it, like democracy, human rights, rule of law, market economy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what we've been, of course, that was a different time, right? I mean, if you look at the early 2000s, you see, or late 1990s, this is the sort of euphoric time for democracy, human rights, and the idea that this is basically now the only way to go, and Europe will be one of the main international players that will exert these values at the global scene. And economies are doing well. There's a lot of cash in the international market, and they're low. You know, we haven't got to that major economic crisis of 2008 yet. So this is the time. This is a right context, you know, both European-wide but also globally, for the normative power Europe discourse to emerge. Now, you know, fast forward, we are in a period where none of those hold true, right? We are in a period where you see democratic violations and regression of democracy globally, but also even within the European Union. So that's like one of the number one reasons why the normative power Europe discourse is being eroded within, right, by what the member states are doing themselves, to themselves and to their societies. And on top of that, of course, the normative power of Europe is being damaged with the way in which it is responding to the repercussions of the geopolitical conflicts, right, in its wider neighborhood and beyond. Because now we are living in a context when geopolitics is on the rise, right? Yeah, various actors, assertive foreign policy actors, singular foreign policy actors, like Russia, for instance, that contest the EU in its wider neighborhood, as well as China, right, to some extent. And the European Union is not apt to deal with this kind of geopolitical competition. And what it deals with, or what it tries to deal with, is the repercussions or consequences of these geopolitical conflicts that are at its doorstep. And the number one, of course, repercussion is migration, right? Because people are really mainly fleeing these war zones. If you look at these major migration waves, such as the one in Syria or Afghanistan or elsewhere, it's mainly due to the conflicts, wider conflicts in the EU's wider neighborhood. And the fact that externalization and border controls and everything else that's being done to deal with these, as Carolina, I think, also outlined excellently, goes to show that it's now eroding this normative power rhetoric also through the way in which it's responding to the consequences and repercussions of an increasingly geopolitical world that's around it. And that's the way it chooses to deal with it, to dealing with a short-term measures that really prioritizes only one thing. And that one thing is to make sure that people stop at the borders before they can even manage to get into the European Union. And what this, of course, is leading to is that it's putting a lot of pressure on border countries as well, like Greece, for instance, which also ultimately leads them to, again, Karina would know this better because she's also done, I know that she's done a lot of field work in these border regions, that basically pushbacks that are against international law, that are against, you know, human dignity in any shape and form. So that's also a further, I think, way in which all this normative power Europe discourse is being eroded. And finally, what it's doing is that by doing all this, a normative power means you cannot be a normative power unless others recognize you to be so. So normativity depends a lot on external recognition of an international actor as a normative actor. And I think what we're seeing here is that third party countries like Turkey, for instance, or even Russia or others are using this lack of principled foreign policy action on this front on the part of the EU as evidence that EU is an international as any actor of the West only out there to prioritize its own interests at the expense of basic human rights. And I'm not saying, of course, that this sort of puts the other third countries that are contesting the EU on these grounds in a more positive light, but they're definitely using it to undermine EU's legitimacy and international standing or credibility on the international scene, or whatever is left of it.
Thank you very much. Maybe also Karolina would like to comment on this issue, and also maybe we can also talk about the cost of these types of management on migrants themselves. How would you comment on that?
Yes, I'm really sorry. There is a construction in our neighbor flat, so I hope that you can hear me. Really,
it's well. Okay.
Just let me know. But yeah, I think that Sinem just pointed to the issue of pushbacks, and often, exactly as she said, it happens at the EU's external or in EU member states who are at the edge of the EU, right? Greece, Croatia, Hungary, and so forth. So, but I think that with the externalizations, this approach is slowly moving further and further across all external borders. And I think Eastern Turkey is a very excellent and very sad example of that. I think that right now the pushbacks, especially after the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, when Turkey suddenly found itself in a position of being again imposed further externalization from the Commission and some of the states, such as Germany, when they're trying to negotiate with the president to really receive more migrants and refugees, but not being able to even legally secure them, to provide them proper protection and long-term solution, right, to stay in the country, to have the right to work, to study, and so forth. And not wanting, Turkey doesn't want to be anymore the space where all the refugees are being thrown or dumped, as the president also highlighted. So the approach that we've been increasingly seeing at the Iran-Turkey border are pushbacks. And even some interviews and some of the data collection pointed that the Turkish Ministry of Interior admitted that they pushed around 90,000 people during 2021, during the single year alone so far. It was the data that I obtained in September. So imagine that if these pushbacks continue, how many people are being pushed to Iran? And when often the Turkish authorities say, well, but we are not at least pushing migrants to the sea, which is dangerous and they can drown. However, we have to realize that the Iran-Turkey border is a mountainous region where the temperatures drop even to minus 20. There's a lot of snow in the winter, and every winter many people die there when they're trying to walk alone or with the smugglers across these borders. Also, what we came out with some interviews with refugees, many of them experienced to witness or to be even subjected to violence by Iranian border guards on the other side of the border. When, for example, one Afghan refugee told me that he saw 14 people being shot by the Iranian border guards in a single sole accident. So I think that these pushbacks are very problematic. It doesn't happen only to Afghans, but it also happened to Iranian citizens who are being persecuted in Iran and which are at a very risk and danger of their lives if they are pushed back to Iran. And the pushbacks, I think, that are very much acknowledged also by Gendarme members who I interviewed, and who said to me, well, we really need to respond by pushbacks because it's a financial burden to accommodate all people in removal centers. And especially with the case of Afghanistan, I mean, all deportations have been halted due to security reasons in Afghanistan. So the pushbacks really became as the primary approach how to deal with especially Afghan migration, which is increasing in Eastern Turkey and which was not really observed before the deal at all. I mean, I even did some comparative interviews with people who crossed this border before 2016, 2015, and they didn't have that problem. They didn't really observe anything like that. So we have to realize that externalization is not only leading to some official, you know, border deterrence and official agreements and something that is so visible, but it often produces unofficial and very problematic border measures along these external borders. There is also a paradox of these measures when often the authorities argue, well, further border militarization and tougher border, let's say, is important because it fights against human smuggling and illegal migration. However, there's a paradox of that, right? I mean, if people don't have any legal and safe passages, they much more rely on smugglers. And what we observed, not just at the Iran-Turkey border, but also at the Bosnian-Croatian border, was that more difficult to cross the border was, people had to pay much more money to smugglers. And when they didn't have that money, they were often selling themselves in a way that they were working for smugglers, or they promised them to work for them once they reach your final destination. So again, there is this argument by policymakers when I was discussing this issue with them, especially in the EU, when they're often really wondering, like, how come that migrants can afford these prices? How come that the smuggling networks are rising? But these prices, this rise of the smuggling networks, and also the modern slavery in these smuggling networks is very much dependent on this border militarization and unofficial and violent measures that I just described. And one more thing I want to point to this also, that the border with externalization, the border doesn't really measure in a sense of a traditional border line when people come to some border cross checkpoint and after they're able to move across it and that's it. No, I mean, the surveillance and border controls are extensive. So during my last trip in Van in September, especially after Turkey sent more troops to the border region, I really met people who were very scared also when moving around Van. There were much more interception operations in Van city, when also some refugee families told me that the border patrols or police were raiding their houses. They were trying to go to the houses which they believed they were housing undocumented migrants. And this whole surveillance was really spreading, not just anymore in border region or the border zone itself, but it was going to the major urban cities and major areas where people lived and where they were planning their further journeys. So again, this is an important point to just mention, that there is no more anymore of just border zone, but it's being spread. And people are not only feared when crossing this border, but this fear continues after they cross the border.
And that's one of the reasons why they don't want to stay in Van and move further away from the border area, maybe. Thank you very much, Karolina, for all these comments also coming from the ground and also from the Van Iran-Turkey border. I would like to thank you for all your comments. Is there anything that you would like to add?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here, Karolina Agustova, Senamayt and Dizkit, and all our viewers. Thank you very much for watching us. I'll see you next week with a different topic. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Have a nice day.
Bye.
Türkiye'nin sivil, bağımsız, özgür ve çoğulcu bir medya ortamına ihtiyacı var. Medyascope, 20 Ağustos 2015'te bu ihtiyacı karşılamak üzere yola çıktı. Ama yolumuz uzun. Bu yolculukta bize Patreon veya YouTube'un katıl butonu üzerinden katkıda bulunabilir.
Yurt dışına çıkacaklara müjde. Miles & Smiles Garanti BBVA kredi kartlarıyla yurt dışında toplam 60 bin lira ve üzeri fiziki alışveriş yapın. Garanti BBVA'daki varlık tutarınıza göre tek yön uçak bileti değerinde 8500 mil kazanın. 30 Nisan'a kadar ilk alışverişinizden önce Bonus Flash'tan kampanyaya katılmayı unutmayın. Ayrıntılı bilgi Miles & Smiles Garanti BBVA.com ve Bonus Flash'ta. Miles & Smiles kredi kartları 2000 yılından beri Garanti BBVA'dan.